Chapter 72. The Battle of Tours. We have now to record the expedition of the Prince of Nemours against his advancing cousin, Henry V. His Royal Highness could not march against the enemy with such a force as he would have desired to bring against them, for his royal father, wisely remembering the vast amount of property he had stowed away under the Tuileries, refused to allow a single soldier to quit the forts round the capital, which thus was defended by 144,000 guns, 84 pounders, and 432,000 men. Little enough, when one considers that there were but 3 men to a gun. To provision this immense army, and a population of double the amount within the walls, His Majesty caused the country to be scoured for 50 miles round, and left neither ox, nor ass, nor blade of grass. When appealed to by the inhabitants of the plundered district, the Royal Philip replied, with tears in his eyes, that his heart bled for them, that they were his children, that every cow taken from the meanest peasant was like a limb torn from his own body, but that duty must be done, that the interests of the country demanded the sacrifice, and that in fact, they might go to the deuce. This the unfortunate creature certainly did. The theaters went on as usual within the walls. The Journal des Debats stated every day that the pretenders were taken. The chambers sat such as remained and talked immensely about honor, dignity, and the glorious revolution of July, and the king, as his power was now pretty nigh absolute over them, thought this a good opportunity to bring in a bill for doubling his children's allowances all round. Meanwhile the Duke of Nemours proceeded on his march, and as there was nothing left within 50 miles of Paris wherewith to support his famished troops, it may be imagined that he was forced to ransack the next 50 miles in order to maintain them. He did so. But the troops were not such as they should have been, considering the enemy with whom they had to engage. The fact is that most of the Duke's army consisted of the National Guard, who, in a fit of enthusiasm, and at the cry of a Patrian danger having been induced to volunteer, had been eagerly accepted by His Majesty, anxious to lessen as much as possible the number of food consumers in his beleaguered capital. It is said, even that he selected the most gormandizing battalions of the civic force to send forth against the enemy, viz., the grocers, the rich bankers, the lawyers, and see their parting with their families was very affecting. They would have been very willing to recall their offer of marching, but companies of stern veterans closing round them, marched them to the city gates, which were closed upon them, and thus perforce they were compelled to move on. As long as he had a bottle of brandy and a couple of sausages in his holsters, the general of the National Guard, Odilon Barrett, talked with tremendous courage. Such was the power of his eloquence over the troops, that, could he have come up with the enemy while his victuals lasted, the issue of the combat might have been very different. But in the course of the first day's march he finished both the sausages and the brandy, and became quite uneasy, silent, and crestfallen. It was on the fair plains of Touraine, by the banks of Silver Loire, that the armies sat down before each other, and the battle was to take place which had such an effect upon the fortunes of France. 'Twas a brisk day of march. The practiced valor of Nemours showed him at once what use to make of the army under his orders, and having enfiladed his National Guard battalions, and placed his artillery in echelons, he formed his cavalry in 2 hollow squares on the right and left of his line, flinging out a cloud of howitzers to fall back upon the main column. His veteran infantry he formed behind his National Guard, politely hinting to Odilon Barrett, who wished to retire under pretense of being exceedingly unwell, that the regular troops would bayonet the National Guard if they gave way an inch. On which their general, turning very pale, demurely went back to his post. His men were dreadfully discouraged. They had slept on the ground all night. They regretted their homes and their comfortable nightcaps in the Rue Saint-Honor. They had luckily fallen in with a flock of sheep and a drove of oxen a tour the day before, But what were these, compared to the delicacies of Chevitzer three courses at Vifer's? They mournfully cooked their steaks and cutlets on their ramrods, and passed a most wretched night. The army of Henry was encamped opposite to them for the most part in better order. The noble cavalry regiments found a village in which they made themselves pretty comfortable, Jenkins Foot taking possession of the kitchens and garrets of the buildings. The Irish brigade, accustomed to lie abroad, were quartered in some potato fields, where they sang Moore's melodies all night. There were, besides the troops regular and irregular, about 3,000 priests and abbots with the army, armed with scourging whips, and chanting the most lugubrious canticles. These reverend men were found to be a hindrance, rather than otherwise, to the operations of the regular forces. It was a touching sight, on the morning before the battle, to see the alacrity with which Jenkins' regiment sprung up at the first reveille of the bell, and engaged the honest fellows in offices almost menial for the benefit of their French allies. The Duke himself set the example, and blacked to a nicety the boots of Henry. At 10:30, after coffee, the brilliant warriors of the cavalry were ready. Their clarions rung to horse, their banners were given to the wind, their shirt collars were exquisitely starched, and the whole air was scented with the odors of their pomatums and pocket handkerchiefs. Jenkins had the honor of holding the stirrup for Henry. "Why, faithful Duke," said the prince, pulling him by the shoulder knot, "thou art always at thy post. Here, as in Wellington Street, sire," said the hero, blushing. And the prince made an appropriate speech to his chivalry, in which allusions to the lilies, St. Louis, Bayard and Henri Quatre, were, as may be imagined, not spared. "Oh, standard bearer," the prince concluded, "fling out my oriflamme. Noble gents of France, your king is among you today." Then turning to the Prince of Balibunian, who had been drinking whiskey punch all night with the princes of Donegal and Connemara, "Prince," he said, "the Irish brigade has won every battle in the French history. We will not deprive you of the honor of winning this. You will please to commence the attack with your brigade." Bending his head until the green plumes of his beaver mingled with the mane of the Shetland pony which he rode, the Prince of Ireland trotted off with his aides-de-camp, who rode the same horses, powerful greys, with which a dealer at Nantes had supplied them on their and the prince's joint bill at 3 months. The gallant sons of Erin had wisely slept until the last minute in their potato trenches, but rose at once at the summons of their beloved prince. Their toilet was the work of a moment, a single shake, and it was done. Rapidly forming into a line, they advanced headed by their generals, who, turning their steeds into a grass field, wisely determined to fight on foot. Behind them came the line of British foot under the illustrious Jenkins, who marched in advance perfectly collected, and smoking a Manila cigar. The cavalry were on the right and left of the infantry, prepared to act in pontoon, in echelon, or in ricochet, as occasion might demand. The prince rode behind, supported by his staff, who were almost all of them bishops, archdeacons, or abbots, and the body of ecclesiastics followed, singing to the sound, or rather howl, of serpents and trombones, the Latin canticles of the Reverend Franciscus O'Mahony, lately canonized under the name of St. Francis of Cork. The advanced lines of the two contending armies were now in presence the National Guard of Orleans and the Irish Brigade. The white belts and fat paunches of the guard presented a terrific appearance, but it might have been remarked by the close observer that their faces were as white as their belts, and the long line of their bayonets might be seen to quiver. General Odilon Barrett, with a cockade as large as a pancake, endeavored to make a speech. The words honor, patrie, francaise, champ de bataille might be distinguished. But the general was dreadfully flustered, and was evidently more at home in the Chamber of Deputies than in the field of war. The Prince of Balibunian, for a wonder, did not make a speech. "Boys," said he, "we've enough talking at the Corn Exchange. Baiting's the word now. The Green Islanders replied with a tremendous hurrah, which sent terror into the fat bosoms of the French. "Gentlemen of the National Guard," said the prince, taking off his hat and bowing to Adelon Barrett, "will ye be so extremely obliging as to fire first?" This he said, because it had been said at Fontenoy, but chiefly because his own men were only armed with shillelaghs, and therefore could not fire. But this proposal was very unpalatable to the National Guardsmen. For though they understood the musket exercise pretty well, firing was the thing of all others they detested the noise, and the kick of the gun, and the smell of the powder, being very unpleasant to them. "He won't fire," said Adelon Barrett, turning round to Colonel Saugrenu and his regiment of the line which, it may be remembered, was formed behind the National Guard. "Then give them the bayonet," said the colonel, with a terrific oath. "Harch! Corbleu!" At this moment, and with the most dreadful howl that ever was heard, the National Guard was seen to rush forwards wildly, and with immense velocity, towards the foe. The fact is, that the line regiment behind them, each selecting his man, gave a poke with his bayonet between the coattails of the Nationals, and those troops bounded forward with an irresistible swiftness. Nothing could withstand the tremendous impetus of that maneuver. The Irish brigade was scattered before it, as chaff before the wind. The Prince of Ballybunion had barely time to run Adelon Barrett through the body, when he too was borne away in the swift rout. They scattered tumultuously, and fled for 20 miles without stopping. The princes of Donegal and Connemara were taken prisoners. But though they offered to give bills at 3 months, and for £100,000, for their ransom, the offer was refused, and they were sent to the rear. When the Duke of Nemours, hearing they were Irish generals, and that they had been robbed of their ready money by his troops, who had taken them prisoners, caused a comfortable breakfast to be supplied to them, and lent them each a sum of money. How generous are men in success! The Prince of Orleans was charmed with the conduct of his National Guards, and thought his victory secure. He dispatched a courier to Paris with the brief words, "We met the enemy before Tours. The National Guard has done its duty. The troops of the pretender are routed. Vive le Roi!" The note, you may be sure, appeared in the Journal des Debats, and the editor, who only that morning had called Henri V. A great prince, an august exile, denominated him instantly a murderer, slave, thief, cutthroat, pickpocket, and burglar. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.